Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the series of Purposeful Intention interviews. We had a little break or intermission there for a couple of weeks, and we're back to it with gusto. Interview number 6 was actually supposed to be my interview, but as many of you know, I've postponed mine until the end of the series. So my Balanced Hormones, Balanced Life interview will now take place on Tuesday, April 30th. Our enrollment for this event certainly didn't wane during our little intermission. We have many new listeners, and I want to extend a warm welcome to everyone. My name is Jill Grunewald, and I'm a holistic nutrition and hormone coach and health and wellness writer. I'm the host and creator of the Purposeful Intention Empowerment Series and the founder of Healthful Elements, where I teach women with adrenal dysfunction and low thyroid function, including autoimmune hypothyroidism or Hashimoto's, how to regain their vitality and alleviate symptoms of these conditions with whole foods nutrition and other natural remedies and lifestyle modifications. So tonight is interview number 6 with Dr. Aviva Ram. Welcome, Aviva.
Thank you, Jill.
Dr. Aviva Ram is a Yale-trained physician specializing in integrative medicine for women and children. She's a midwife, an herbalist, an award-winning author, and the creator-owner of WomanWise, online courses dedicated to vitality and optimal health for women and children. An internationally respected expert in botanical and integrative medicine, she has spent nearly 30 years as a healthcare practitioner and advocate. The recent past president of the American Herbalist Guild, a founder of the Yale Integrative Medicine Program, and the author of 7 books on natural medicine for women and children, Aviva is one of the first pioneers in natural birth and botanical medicine for gynecology, obstetrics, and pediatrics in the United States. Her books are read and loved around the world. She's also sought out as a botanical medicine industry consultant, medical journal editor and contributor, is the medical director of and a frequent contributor to the American Herbal Pharmacopoeia, and has contributed to several important integrative medicine textbooks. Aviva recognizes that the current medical system is failing people because of its lack of listening to and truly caring for the individual, and in its focus on disease management and overdiagnosis rather than on health promotion. She knows that the epidemic of chronic disease we are facing is not inevitable. It is preventable and reversible if we look for and treat the root causes. Practicing what she calls good medicine and transformational healing, Aviva is a leader in the healthcare revolution, transforming the current medical system that over-medicalizes life from birth to death into a model that respects the intrinsic healing capacities of the body and nature. I found out about Dr. Ram because of Dr. Mark Hyman. I suspect that many of you know who he is. He's a well-known functional medicine doctor, New York Times bestselling author, and founder of the Ultra Wellness Center in Massachusetts. Dr. Ram recently began working with Dr. Hyman at the clinic, and I saw one of his Facebook posts about her, and I thought, wow, this is someone I need to know about. I immediately started following her on Facebook and signed up for her newsletter, and it's by far one of the best newsletters I get. And let me tell you, I'm on a lot of newsletters, too many newsletters. So welcome, Aviva.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are a midwife, a Yale-trained physician, an herbalist, an advocate, an ecologist. You've been a healthcare practitioner for 30 years. Have you always been so socially, ecologically, and environmentally conscious, or is this something that has evolved as your career has evolved?
Well, I haven't always been, but I've been for a really long time. I had the unusual experience of going from actually growing up in a housing project in New York City to leaving New York City at 15 to start college. So
wow.
I was pretty young when I became sort of ecologically and politically minded. It was around when I was 15. I, you know, changed my diet, became a vegetarian, started studying herbal medicine, started studying midwifery. And at that time, it was really during kind of the nuclear arms escalation. And, you know, it was scary. I was a teenager. It was scary. I was idealistic. So I think I had this idea that I really needed to learn how to take care of myself as far as food and medicine should kind of everything hit the fan, which that sort of seemed like it could happen at that time. So really it has seemed like it's been always, but not really always.
So what piqued your interest in natural medicine versus medicine as it's typically practiced today? I mean, you kind of answered this question already, but you call it an over-medicalization model. Was there a person or experience that influenced the path your career as a physician has taken?
It wasn't really any one kind of galvanizing experience. It was really part of that evolution of when I was young. That time in my life took me to a lot of different reading, a lot of different exposure and experience on how the pharmaceutical companies and the military industry and the medical industry really didn't benefit from people being healthy or from peacetime. Really, there's a lot of profit to be made in generating illness. So the trajectory for me was a little bit backwards in the sense that I pursued my passions in alternative medicine before there really was anything called alternative medicine. So I pursued it out of school. There were certainly some people who influenced my knowledge and my perspectives along the way. A couple of midwives, one named Ina Mae Gaskin, who was and is part of a large commune in Tennessee where they basically took birth back in their own hands. And Ina Mae Gaskin has been a hugely influential person not only in my life but in kind of the countercultural movement in home birth in this country. Interestingly, she's actually one of only two women to ever have an obstetrics procedure named after them as well that they developed. So she's a formidable character. And I met her when I was very young. She wrote the foreword to my first book when I was in my mid-20s. Another was another midwife who has now passed away, but also a close friend. Her name was Janine Parvati Baker. Janine died of actually a hepatitis infection that was contracted from a medical injection that was necessary after the birth of one of her babies. But she was a pioneering midwife. She wrote the first book on prenatal yoga. In fact, it was one of the first modern books on yoga in the United States in the last 30 years. And a few herbalists who were really supportive and influential for me. Also, Michael Tierra was one of those. There were also a couple of doctors who at that time were some of the first to speak out about the potential for parents to take their kids' health back in their own hands. One was a Dr. Robert Mendelson and another Dr. George Wu Tan, who really spoke about how moms were the ones that knew when their kids were well and knew when their kids were healthy, and trusting that mom instinct was incredibly important. So those are some of the big influences for me.
So thank you for that. Mm-hmm. What is botanical medicine exactly?
Well, botanical medicine means a lot of different things to different people. It's the oldest medicine we have, and so if you're living in a very traditional tribal environment, you're in a tribe in the Amazon or somewhere in South Africa or anywhere in the world in Eastern Europe, sometimes it is, and certainly in most of the Indian continent, the only medicine that people have is botanical medicine. There really isn't any access to Western medicine. And then in our culture, botanical medicine is any use of plants for part of one's healing. And that can encompass everything from very traditional kind of kitchen folk medicine to much more elaborate medical herbalism, where people actually go to schools, get even graduate level training in how to use herbal medicines as part of or as the primary healing protocol for a large number of common to more serious health concerns.
It's always made me chuckle that botanical medicine or herbal medicine is seen by some as alternative or newfangled or counterculture, when in fact, like you said, it's been around for a very long time, and it respects the intrinsic healing capacities of the body and nature. Why have we been so quick to adopt any other healing models in this? Why have we sort of moved away from it to a large degree?
It's a great question. I actually run this Herbal Medicine for Women distance learning course, and one of the questions I actually ask my students is, why is it controversial to consider herbal medicine alternative? And it's exactly as you put it. It really isn't the alternative. It's the original medicine, and everything else is sort of now the alternative to what has been used for thousands of years.
Yeah, yeah.
We really only have contemporary or modern medicine for the past 100 years in any sort of systematized way. I think for me, I look at everything as sort of a continuum. And when we look back in history, clearly there must have been many conditions that were faced by communities where herbal medicine maybe wasn't always adequate enough for treatment, and people became sick and people died. And certainly as Western modern culture has evolved, the quest for more medications to provide more intervention for more people has arisen. So I don't think there's any of us that wouldn't in some way feel grateful for the advent of antibiotics. So I suspect that people felt there was a need for more and so pursued more. That has been complicated and confounded by many different factors. One, the whole construct of Western medicine is really built around the idea of a conquest over nature and a domination over nature rather than harmonizing with nature. So there's a sense of the body as a machine that can break and can be fixed rather than this sort of whole organism with an innate healing capacity. That, on top of that, the fix or the repair for the machine has taken a very technological spin. A lot of how medicine manifests in any particular culture is a direct reflection of the values of that culture. So if you look at traditional Chinese medicine, the language and construct reflect traditional Chinese spirituality or political values. The same in Ayurveda, the same in any different Native American tribe, it's going to reflect those spiritual and cultural and mechanical values. Our culture is a technological culture, and that's the value that is reflected in contemporary medicine. So we don't, as a culture, spend a lot of time in nature or respecting nature or trusting nature. We tend to sort of build parking lots or do surgeries or give pharmaceutical responses to things. So it really is just that reflection. And within that has arisen an incredibly large profit-driven incentive model. So it's very complicated, and the American public has really been led to believe that that is the only way, that the things that our grandmothers would have done are hokey or old school or, you know, any kind of derogatory terms that would be given to something that's really old-fashioned. And that's really where we're at right now.
So correct me if I'm
and
wrong.
And also, if you don't mind my adding, it's easy.
Yeah.
It's easier. You know, it's easy. It's hard when you're a working parent, and taking care of your child naturally means sort of letting an illness run its course, which might mean taking off from work for 3 to 5 days, preparing herbal teas, giving supplements, and giving that one-on-one time that, of course, many people wish they could give. But it really becomes a lot easier to just give an antibiotic, see somebody get well in 24 hours and send them back to school or be able to go back to work.
This completely aligns with my follow-up question, which is, given that we kind of live in a culture where, you know, we have a need for speed, and I can only assume that the transition into a more, you know, medicalized model was largely a product of the drugs being able to potentially work faster, because with any holistic or natural remedy, there's no silver bullet. So I can assume that we were probably told that, oh, drugs can help you heal faster. Like these newfangled, you know, drugs can help you feel better in a shorter period of time versus those time-honored strategies that, like you said, take, you know, some time and attention to administer.
They often do. I mean, there are botanicals that do work quickly. In fact, I posted a blog on my website last week about natural treatments for ear infections, and it's been amazing how many people have written to me in the course of the week saying, you know, my child had an ear infection last night, and I did this, and they were feeling so much better by this morning. So there are things that do work expediently, but for the most part, allowing the body and allowing nature to take its course means that we're supporting the body, and that can take some time as opposed to just sort of tamping down the symptoms, which is a lot of what Western medicine does. It gets rid of the symptoms, assuming that that is getting rid of the underlying cause, when it's really not. And often it's suppressing the body's healing ability rather than supporting it. So sometimes we end up with consequences down the line that we don't anticipate.
Yeah. So what are the primary ways that botanical medicine helps us?
There are many ways. So from an ecological perspective, they certainly are gentler on the earth, especially if we're looking at sustainably planted and sustainably harvested crops compared to a much more petrochemical type of model of pharmaceutical production, which is much more industrial with a lot of industrial waste. In fact, I just read an article recently about fish in the Maryland Bay Area that are now completely feminized just because of pharmaceutical waste in the water, largely from estrogen and contraceptive chemical waste. So from an environmental perspective, they help us because we can't really separate our health from the long-term health of the planet. That's really our largest resource, our most important resource. And then on a personal level, they're definitely, for the most part, gentler medicines. They don't typically have the same side effects or the magnitude or concern of side effects that a lot of pharmaceuticals have. So you can take a botanical medicine and treat an underlying cause and actually support the body rather than just giving something to suppress a symptom that may cause collateral side effects. An example of that would be using something like elderberry and echinacea for an upper respiratory infection, which is usually a viral infection, but you can use them for bacterial infections as well, which are actually nourishing and boosting the immune system without killing beneficial gut flora compared to antibiotics, which with kids, for example, as many as 70% of antibiotics given to kids are unnecessarily prescribed and can cause all kinds of problems like disruption in gut flora, which can lead to long-term consequences of inflammatory bowel disease, can lead to ear infection, resistant infections like pneumonia, and even cause asthma. So they're just a gentler, more physiologically supportive approach. And so those are some of the ways that botanicals can help us. And there are so many different botanicals for so many different physical illnesses that really there's an endless repertoire of what we can use for treatment.
I'd love for you to share with us your three top botanicals for three top problems.
Okay, I had to think about this really hard. I know you sent this one question to me ahead of time, which I'm so grateful for, because it's like asking someone to pick their favorite song and then you can't think of one. So I tried to think.
And I'm dying to hear the ones that you chose.
And there are so many botanicals that I don't necessarily have a favorite for a condition, because I really work so individually with what's going on with any different person at any different time. So I tried to think about what three botanicals would be most universal and address the problems that I think we're most facing as adult Americans. So I chose ashwagandha, which is an herb in a class called adaptogens. And if you're doing work with adrenals, Jill, I'm sure you know about the adaptogens.
Yes, I have a big smile on my face. Yes.
And ashwagandha is my favorite of all the adaptogens. In some ways, I think of it as the most feminine one for some reason, but that's just my sort of like anthropomorphizing the plants. But unlike ginseng, which is also in this category, it doesn't actually drive the adrenals quite. It's not as stimulating. And it has so many other properties. So for those of you who are listening who are unfamiliar with botanicals, adaptogens are a very benign, non-specific class of herbs which are non-toxic and support the body's stress response. And so many different aspects of our health are influenced or impacted by the stress response. just to name a few, inflammation, pain, insulin resistance, and our immune health, and then just our general ability to respond and cope with the everyday stresses of life. So ashwagandha is probably my top get. If I had to put one herb in the water in the United States, I'd put ashwagandha in there. It's super safe. It's generally not recommended during pregnancy, but it can be taken during breastfeeding. It can be given to children. And what I love about ashwagandha is that it can be used long-term for this kind of general support that I'm talking about, but it can actually be used more acutely for musculoskeletal pain and inflammation and even to promote sleep. So I love that about it. And the dose is about 3 to 6 grams a day of the powder, or about 2 to 7 milliliters of a liquid extract. So that's my number one.
Can I ask you a follow-up question about that?
Yeah.
Because I really get on my soapbox about ashwagandha. I've been a huge fan of it for a number of years, and I often talk about it with my clients. And a few of my clients have gotten really overstimulated from ashwagandha, and they have switched to holy basil and felt much better. And they're both, you know, adaptogenic herbs. What is your opinion about, because I agree with you, you said it doesn't drive the adrenals, it doesn't push the adrenals, and that's why I've sort of singled out ashwagandha over other adaptogens, but I have had a few instances where people feel much better on holy basil. What do you think is going on there?
Well, I'm not sure what would be going on for those individual folks, because ashwagandha is usually the more sedating of them. So what comes to mind is a number of things. One is that anybody can have kind of an idiosyncratic response to an herb. So that's one piece. So what might work for you might work differently for me. The other thing is that sometimes when people are used to being really exhausted, and then you start to give them something that feels really nourishing, but they start to get a little bit, they feel better than they're used to feeling, that might feel overstimulating for them. But holy basil is a wonderful adaptogen, and it's delicious, it's fragrant, it's certainly in my top few herbs that I use as adaptogens. It works a little bit differently. It works more, it's very aromatic, and so you can also use it for things like fevers and chills and stomach upsets and bronchitis, whereas I wouldn't use ashwagandha that way. Ashwagandha I would use more for sleep and musculoskeletal discomfort. So a lot of times it's just learning what the energy of the herb is and learning to match that with the person. And certainly it's sometimes it's trial and error, like you experienced. You try one thing and then you find the next right thing for that person. And the beauty of the botanicals is that for the most part, the common ones out there are so non-toxic that you can afford to try one and then go to another.
What did you think?
What was your sense of what was happening?
What you said about the idiosyncratic nature of herbs and supplements, you know, we're not all going to respond the same to different things. So my instinct was just this particular herb is not right for this particular person.
Mm-hmm. It's so
true.
That
was the best thing I could come up with.
Yeah, it's
because
like
I know so many people who've had such phenomenal results with ashwagandha.
Yeah.
So,
well, like when someone comes into my clinic and they say they have fatigue, I have to really dig and say, well, what does that mean? You know, is it fatigue? Is it mental fatigue? Do you feel tired at the end of the day? Do you feel sleepy in the middle of the day? Do you feel sleepy after or tired after you eat certain foods? Is it brain fog? Is it actually like in your muscles where you just like your arms are heavy to lift? There's so many different manifestations of what that means. So really drilling down for that person, that can sometimes help to pick the right herb.
So I broke your stride. Go ahead.
No, you're good. I'm good in the flow. So you want the next herb?
Yeah.
Okay. So the next one that I thought would be very universally valuable is turmeric. And the reason I picked turmeric is that so many folks are struggling with chronic inflammation, autoimmune conditions, and a lot of disruption in health comes down to inflammation in the gut too. So turmeric is an all-around kind of gets all of those aspects. It's great for inflammation if you have arthritis, musculoskeletal pain. For patients with autoimmune conditions, I use it to help kind of cool down the autoimmune system.
Yes.
And
yes,
for patients who have, for folks who have gut problems where they have a lot of IBS or inflammatory bowel or just underlying gut inflammation that is contributing to those other problems, turmeric is a fantastic herb. It can be used in shakes. It can be used in capsules. It can be used in liquid extracts. And it can be cooked in our food. And food is our first best medicine. So that's my second pick. And then my third pick is one of my favorite herbs in the category called nervines, or herbs that support or relax or restore the nervous system, and that's passion flower. And the reason I picked that is because so many of us have disrupted or dysregulated sleep, either difficulty falling asleep or staying asleep or disrupted dreams or waking up tired. And sleep is one of the good refreshing sleep is one of the most important restorative aspects of our health. So I thought something that promotes sleep is going to be an important herb to share, and passion flower is one of my favorite herbs for sleep. Also, so many people struggle with anxiety, and passion flower is a gentle, wonderful botanical for anxiety. It's a great alternative to a lot of anxiety medications, even benzos, believe it or not. It works beautifully. And what's nice about it is that in modest-sized doses, you can even take it throughout the day to reduce your stress. It doesn't make you sleepy if you take small doses. And then you can take a little more before bed to help with sleep. And you can even take it if you wake up in the night to help you go back to sleep. So those are my three top picks, Jill.
I'd love to ask you a follow-up question about turmeric, which I also love, 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 and I also get on my soapbox about, because it's an immune modulator. I mean, yes, it does a lot of the wonderful things that you already mentioned from the standpoint of reducing inflammation, but one of the reasons I really love it is because it's an immune modulator. It helps to actually tame that fire of autoimmunity. And for the last couple of years, I've been instructing people to make sure that they get a turmeric, if they're going to supplement with it, make sure that they get one that has the presence of piper nigrum in it or black pepper, because I read some studies that said that it's really only bioavailable to the body in the presence of piper nigrum. And then I read a study that countered that and said, no, actually, that's not true. What is your opinion about the presence of black pepper with the turmeric?
Black pepper is a really interesting substance. There have been some studies looking at black pepper's effect in the liver of augmenting the enzyme systems that help to make drugs more bioavailable. So in India, for example, where there's a shortage of certain medications, there have been studies showing that if you give black pepper, it augments the effectiveness of those medications, so you can spare the amount, make a little bit, go further. So that may be where that thought or idea originated, but the effects of turmeric absolutely stand on their own, so you don't have to have black pepper.
You don't
have to have black pepper to make the turmeric bioavailable. It is interesting, though, that when we think about Indian cooking, right, where turmeric kind of originates from, there's typically a combination of spices, and black pepper is often in there.
Right.
And
right.
Turmeric itself is enormously valuable as an anti-inflammatory herb. Curcumin, which is the active ingredient in turmeric, can also be obtained in botanical formulas, and curcumin is actually the most active part of it. So to get enough turmeric in your diet to have substantial anti-inflammatory effects, you'd have to consume an enormous amount. So you can get products that have standardization to 95% curcuminoids, and those are the ones that are going to be the most bioactive.
Okay, great. So with herbs, how do we know what's safe and what's not?
That's a great question, and it's tough. Because there is a lot of misinformation out there. You know, you can find every different book is going to have a list of different herbs that are unsafe or different herbs that interact with drugs. And a lot of the information out there is based either on speculation around what chemical constituents are in those herbs and how they might affect the physiology of a person. The biggest concerns that people usually have are interactions with drugs. So what I would say is that access to a couple of good basic resources is really helpful. There's the Natural Standards database is one of them, Natural Standards, that a lot of folks find fairly accurate. Dr. Weil's website tends to have accurate information, Andy Weil's website on botanicals. He's got an herbalist in his midst, Tirone Lodog, who is amazing, and so she is the go-to person in Dr. Weil's community for botanicals. So that information is highly reliable. And what I would generally say is just to err on the side of safety, before you do use any botanicals with pharmaceuticals, either check with your physician or check with a licensed naturopath in your community who is knowledgeable about botanical and drug interactions. And there are some herbalists out there who are knowledgeable as well. I generally tell folks, if you're self-medicating with herbs, you know, you read about something on the internet, you want to try it. If you're on a medication that without it, it'd be a life-threatening situation for you, so you have an autoimmune disease, you don't want to just go off your autoimmune medications. If you're on medications for HIV or hepatitis or something really significant, or if you're on medications for blood thinning because you've had a stroke or a heart attack, those medications, if you go off of them or an herb interferes with them, your risks are higher. So if you're on anything like that, check with your physician before you start taking botanicals. But for the most part, the actual reported adverse effects of botanicals are extremely small, and similarly, the number of reports of interactions with pharmaceutical medications is negligible.
Thank you for reminding me about the Natural Standards database. I had kind of forgotten about that website, and the question I wanted to ask next may be partially answered by what you just said. Common questions I get from my clients related to herbs are dosing and contraindications, which we've touched on. And, you know, I always refer people to an herbalist or I tell them to dose according to the directions on the product. Do you have any general advice for self-dosing or a go-to resource for sleuthing out contraindications? And I guess my follow-up question would be, does the Natural Standard database talk about contraindications?
It does. Natural Standards does talk about contraindications. So you can go there and look at herb-drug interactions and contraindications.
Okay.
You know, generally I tell people if you're in the first trimester of pregnancy, avoid all botanicals unless there's some medical necessity, and then work with someone who's really skilled. So first trimester of pregnancy, or like I said, if you're on a high-stakes medication. Those would be the two times I'd be super careful. And then also with babies. But otherwise, for folks who want to dose, using the dosing that, self-medicate, the dosing that's on packages that you're going to get at a natural food store or an herb shop, if anything, are on the lower side of effective. So that's what I would usually just say, is follow the recommended dosing on the package for any individual product.
An herbalist that I've worked with here in the Twin Cities was talking about how I don't know, you know, what brands you recommend or what you work with, but I'm sure you're familiar with the brand Herb Farm, PHARM.
Yep. They're one of my faves.
Okay, me too. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, almost every single one of those labels for the dosing says take between 30 and 40 drops 2 to 3 times per day.
Mm-hmm.
And my herbalist friend laughed and said, that is an astronomical dose of most of these herbs. Do you feel like the Herb Farm brand is the those dosing guidelines are the lower side of effective?
Well, so there are a couple of things to think about. One is that there is definitely a movement in the Twin Cities area toward what is known as drop dosing, just because there has been an herbalist in that region who's very well known, who focuses on this idea that you can use like a single drop to
affect. We may
affect,
be talking about the same person.
Probably so. So most herbalists don't find that to be clinically effective.
Okay.
So that's sort of like one extreme of the spectrum. And then if you were to look at dosing in, for example, the UK or Germany or France, where botanical medicine is really part of the mainstay of conventional medicine, the dosing would be at the other extreme. So 30 to 40 drops is about 2 or 3 milliliters. And in Europe, a standard dose might be 5 to 7 milliliters of an herb, you know, 3 to 4 times a day. So it's very variable. It really does depend on the specific herb. I think when you're a company like Herb Farm or Gaia or any of the big herb companies, you can't really necessarily say, okay, well, if you weigh this much, take this much. If you're this age, take this much. And if you have this condition, because you can't fit all that on a label. So they kind of try to come up with an average dosing that's going to be most effective for the most people. So really going into a store and buying herbs off a shelf is amazing, and the ability to take our health in our own hands is so important. And at the same time, it's not necessarily a substitute for having a qualified herbalist or naturopath or physician who can walk you through what a really appropriate dosing for you as an individual would be. So that said, no, I don't think that the Herb Farm dosing is astronomical or inappropriate at all.
Okay. That's interesting to me that the Twin Cities is kind of, quote-unquote, on the map for drop dosing. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean,
you know,
it's around the country, but that's kind of where it originated.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
So you've said that you're on fire about creating a better world, and from what I can tell, you're doing a darn good job at it. And, you know,
thank
you recently
you.
Joined Dr. Hyman's Ultra Wellness Center, and you're doing all kinds of other amazing work, your programs, your books, et cetera. And I recently read that you were on the advisory council for the new book, The American Herbal Products Association's Botanical Safety Handbook.
Yep.
How do you juggle all of this?
Oh, gosh. Well, I have a lot of natural energy, and I'm really motivated. You know, when I look at the numbers of kids, it's now like 1 in 80 kids on the autistic spectrum. 30% of women are going to have a C-section. 50% of people are obese and going to have diabetes. I feel that is part of my personal responsibility, and I don't think that people who don't feel that that's their responsibility are somehow not living up to theirs, but for me, that's part of my personal mission. And what really gives me energy and inspires me is making that contribution to the world. So I'm not a big TV watcher. I really do come home from the clinic and my husband will say, what do you want to do tonight? And I'll say, I really want to read about something I learned today, or I really want to write a blog about something that's important.
Yeah, I'm
so
the same way.
So that is kind of my pastime. So my work and my life, it's like it's all hobby to me. I love it. But that said, I'm also really good at knowing when to put down my work and just take some quiet time or engage in art or engage in nature or just engage with my kids or cooking in the kitchen or just getting goofy. Like I am a big air guitar, solo dance party, Motown, rock and roll kind of girl. So just having fun and, you know, having that balance in my life, and also just accepting that life isn't always about balance. I mean, right now I'm in a phase of kind of being on fire with that passion and going with that.
You
have really
four...
good – what's that?
Go ahead.
I was going to say my partner is super supportive, so he never minds, you know, taking my car in for inspection so I can write a blog, or just kind of giving me that support.
Yeah,
is really,
wonderful.
Really wonderful as a mom too. So yeah.
Yeah, you have 4 children, correct?
I do. They're grown and a grandbaby too.
Oh, little. Wow!
Tiny little grandbaby. Yeah. Thank you.
So before we get to questions, I would love for you to tell our listeners a little more about WomanWise, your online courses that focus on women's and children's health. I'd love to know more about them too.
Yeah, so this is my growing enterprise, and it's in process. I started my first course, which is herbal medicine for women, about 7 years ago, and now it's growing in leaps and bounds. I've got 400 students all around the world.
Wow.
And that is for folks who want to be pretty serious about bringing botanical medicines for women into an existing herbal medicine or midwifery or medical or naturopathic or acupuncture or massage therapy practice. So people who are either wanting to get off the ground as practitioners or who are already practitioners, and it's almost like a fellowship or graduate level course. But really where I want to continue to make a contribution and grow my contribution is helping individuals, helping women be able to take back their health into their hands, get control or get acceptance and healing around hormonal dysregulation and fertility issues and just the things that women struggle with. And as an extension of that, when you're a mom, you struggle with your kids' health because you want to provide the most natural, optimal choices for kids. So what I am in the process of creating is a variety of courses that are very affordable, accessible, and online. My first course that's going to come out late summer, early fall is called Pediatrics for Parents. And it is just what it says. It's all about teaching parents how to recognize when their kids are sick, what can be taken care of at home, when you need a doctor, and then just a wealth of natural approaches that I've gathered from my 28 years of being a mom and being a grandmom and an herbalist and a midwife caring for lots of kids and a family doctor where I've cared for thousands of kids. So that's what's in the works.
Wow, that is amazing.
Yes, and folks can sign up at my website. We do not inundate people's mailboxes by any means. I try to just send out meaningful blogs on a regular basis. Thank you. That's the way to get updates on when the course will be available.
And I just wanted to say to all of our listeners, remember what I said about Aviva's newsletter being one of the best that I get. I do recommend that you all sign up for it. You can do so at her homepage at www.avivaromm.com, AVIVAROMM.com. So in addition to getting immediate access to a downloadable copy of Aviva's ebook, Herbs for Kids, Taking Charge of Your Child's Health Naturally, other things will follow, right, Aviva, like access to free videos and event updates,
exactly,
and classes and
exactly.
Anything else you want to expand on there?
Yeah, we're actually adding a new resources page. This is the disadvantage. I need three of me. But we are adding a new resources page that's going to have because my community, some people really are not moms. They're interested in menopause because they're in their 40s or 50s or 60s, and some are young women in their 20s who haven't had kids yet, and then I've got moms. You know, I try to provide a variety of resources that are valuable for you at whatever stage you're at. So we're expanding in probably the next 2 or 3 months. There'll be a handful of different resources. So when you sign up for the website, you'll actually have inside access to a resources page where you can download one or as many of the resources there. And that will be a piece I'm working on right now, 50 Ways to Prevent Cesarean Sections. A daily detox, which talks about how you don't have to do a specific detox, but you can make your food and your supplements and your herbs every day a part of your life so that your body is maximizing its own innate detox. And then some other goodies, too.
Great.
Yeah.
So are you ready for some questions?
I'm ready. Bring them on.
Okay. So a few questions came through on the webcast kind of early-ish on. And we ended up sort of addressing some of these. So I'm just kind of trying to, some of these may be just slightly, I don't want to say repetitive, but. Okay.
I can spin it. I can add a spin
okay.
on it.
Okay. So this is from Jenny in St. Louis, Missouri. She says, I've heard a lot of contradictory information about maca. I've heard that it's a super herb, and I'm intrigued by it, but I've heard that some people don't do well with it. What is your opinion?
So maca is a wonderful, nourishing herb. It's could be considered in that class of adaptogens. It contains a lot of constituents that are just generally supportive for the body. It's high in essential fatty acids and minerals and vitamins. It's terrific for promoting fertility in men and women, and just as a daily tonic for somebody who has even just fatigue and you know just needs a little bit more intrinsic energy but doesn't want to get it through artificial means like stimulants like caffeine. I mean, caffeine's natural, but, you know, something that's going to drive the adrenals. So you can even pop it in a smoothie. The main thing about maca is that there is some potential for it to interfere with thyroid hormone function. So for people who have completely normal thyroid function, it's fine. It shouldn't cause any problems. But for people who are already hypothyroid, if you have thyroid dysfunction, it may interfere with your thyroid medication. So in that case, it's fine to go ahead and take it, but you'll want to have your thyroid levels measured just to make sure. And because it is so pro-fertility and hormonally, have some chemical constituents that act like phytosterols in the body or phytohormones, plant hormones, I don't recommend it during the breastfeeding.
So
but it's generally quite safe.
Okay. Just to clarify, it interferes with thyroid medication or it interferes with someone who tends towards hypothyroidism but is medication?
Usually, if you tend towards hypothyroidism or if you're on thyroid medication, it can interfere with your thyroid function. So you may need to adjust your medication even to a little bit higher dose. Some people, though, find that once they start to get adrenal support, their thyroid actually starts to function better so they can reduce their medication. So it's going to be a very individualized response. And most people do not have any effects on their thyroid from maca. If you have completely normal thyroid function, it shouldn't interfere with your thyroid at all, though.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Sorry if that wasn't clear.
No, you clarified beautifully. Thank you. So this is a question from Rachel in Brooklyn. She just says, what is your opinion about turmeric? And we've talked about how much we both love it. I don't know if you want to say anything more about it, but
don't buy raw turmeric at the supermarket and cut it on your cutting board because your cutting board will be yellow forever and so will your hands. That's my one advice with turmeric.
This is from
Michelle.
It does
really stain.
What?
It stains.
It's a great stain. Like
it's a great dye.
Right? This is from Michelle in Crested Butte, Colorado. One of my friends stopped taking progesterone cream and started taking Vitex and swears by it, but I'm afraid to stop taking my progesterone cream. What is your opinion about Vitex versus replacement progesterone?
Oh, Vitex is an amazing herb for supporting progesterone, and I have worked with women who have had histories of miscarriage because of progesterone insufficiency. They start taking Vitex, get pregnant, and stay pregnant. It really is fabulous. The only thing I would say about Vitex and progesterone is if you're on progesterone cream to oppose estrogen because you're trying to prevent endometrial cancer, if you still have a uterus and you're taking estrogen as hormone replacement, there's really no way to quantify the progesterogenic effect. You can't say, I'm going to take this much Vitex and it's going to sort of produce this much estrogen for me. So that's the one time I'd be cautious and work with your care provider just to make sure that you're getting the appropriate amount of opposed progesterone or that somebody's at least monitoring you as you're doing it. But Vitex is a very safe herb. In fact, the book that you were talking about, Jill, that I recently was on the advisory panel for that's just come out, the Botanical Safety Handbook, we established in that book for the first time that Vitex is actually safe during pregnancy. So for women who do have low progesterone, if that's why they're taking it, and they want to use the Vitex instead, we now know that you can continue it through the first trimester, which is really wonderful because that's where the miscarriages would usually occur due to low progesterone.
I apologize. I should have said this before, and I know that it's pretty evident for people who are on the webcast that you just type your questions into the field on the left of your screen. But for people who are on the phone, you can press star 2 to raise your hand, and I will call on you by calling out the last 4 digits of your phone number. Sorry, I didn't mention that before. Okay, so back to the webcast questions. This is from Becky in Scottsdale, Arizona. Do you have a recommended resource for finding local midwives? I know that there are some online sources, but I'd love your recommendation.
Yeah, the best way is to go to either one of two websites, the North American Registry of Midwives or the Midwives Alliance of North America, which are sister organizations to each other, and work with a certified professional midwife off of their list. And they have lists regionally.
Great. This is from Chloe in Detroit, Michigan. As a doctor, do you ever prescribe drugs versus herbs?
I do. Absolutely. So, for example, I had a patient who came in recently who had had 2 pulmonary emboli and wanted to go off of his anticoagulant medication and see if he could try herbs instead. And I said, no, we have to keep on that anticoagulation medication. So when there's a really serious medical condition that I need to be able to know I'm going to get X results in Y time using XYZ dose, that's when I'll use medications first. Also, just with time and experience, you know, I've been using botanicals for 30 years, so I have a pretty good comfort zone with when botanicals are going to work and when they're not. And there are a few conditions, for example, pinworms in kids, just to speak of one random one, because I wrote a blog on that recently, where I have just found that the amount of herbs that you would have to give, the taste of them, the toxicity potential in giving those large doses to young children, for example, just isn't as effective as giving the pharmaceutical. So pretty much for any of the intestinal worms, I would use the pharmaceuticals instead. But, yeah, there are lots of different examples. Birth control, if people want to be on a pharmaceutical contraceptive, the botanical ones really don't work. So I'll say this is a time when you have to use a pharmaceutical. So, there are lots of times. You know, I always just try to use what's appropriate for any given situation and what's the safest and most effective for that individual at the time.
Great. This is from Heather in Syracuse. Would you say tinctures are the best way to use botanicals, or are pills, powders as effective?
That's a great question. So, first of all, it depends on the herb. So some herbs are best extracted in water, and some herbs are best extracted in alcohol. The beauty of tinctures is that it's hydroethanolic, so it uses water and alcohol, so you can get a great extraction. So some herbs actually are best as teas. And when you think about something like chamomile or lemon balm, where part of the effectiveness of the medicine is actually breathing in that relaxing scent, then sometimes it can even be as simple as a tea that's the most effective medicine. Or if you want to get something to kind of coat the GI tract, you want something that's going to really slide down there. You actually want to drink it as a tea. Tinctures are fantastic for things that are not well extracted in water, so like hard, rooty type of herbs or tough leaves. And also tinctures have the absolutely fantastic advantage of the fact that they're in alcohol. It means they're preserved for years. I mean, you can really use a lot of tinctures for decades even. And they're easily portable. Capsules and pills and tablets are extremely variable in their quality. Just like when you're grinding up flax seeds or flour or nuts, once something is ground up and exposed to air, there's the potential for rancidity and the potential for oxidation, which is what happens with rancidity, and then you can actually lose some of the important, essential, effective qualities just to that natural exposure to air process or grinding process. So the effectiveness of any pill, capsule, or dried preparation is going to depend on the quality of the product that was started with, and then also the skill of the manufacturer.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
This is from Carolyn in Ithaca. I'm wondering what your opinion is about cause and treatment of ovarian cysts not related to polycystic ovarian syndrome.
Well, there are a lot of different kinds of ovarian cysts, so it really depends. A lot of times there can just be local inflammation. There can be what we call pelvic stagnation, so just some inadequate blood flow to the pelvis, so you're not getting good flow, blood flow to the ovaries or good drainage through the lymph system. Those are really the two most common things. So when I have a woman who comes to me with ovarian cysts, a lot of times time will just take care of it on its own. And so it's more a matter of just helping with reducing inflammation and pain. And I do that a number of ways. I use botanicals that are anti-inflammatory and pain-relieving. Cramp bark is one of my favorite for those. And I also use a lot of hydrotherapy, so alternating hot and cold baths, or even massage, gentle massage to the area with some warm oil can be really relieving of the discomfort and the pain. But it totally depends on what kind of ovarian cyst there is. I usually do recommend for women who have ovarian cysts to go on a very simple diet with a lot of vegetables, juices, and reduce the amount of dairy and meat for a while, just because those can be pro-inflammatory, particularly in the setting of ovarian cysts. So I don't recommend a vegetarian type of diet for everyone all the time, but that in that case I often do.
This is from Josie in Tallahassee, Florida, who says, what is your recommendation for seasonal allergies?
Ah, I just did a blog today.
Yeah, yeah, I saw
it's a
that.
Big one. So in a nutshell, my favorite go-to remedies that work kind of in a jiff, like you can just have seasonal allergies and start to take them and they'll clear up, is a combination of quercetin, which is a bioflavonoid from plants, and freeze-dried stinging nettles. It has to be freeze-dried because that preserves the little formic acid crystals in the stinging part of the leaves. And just take that. You can get products over the counter, and a typical dose would be 3 to 6 capsules a day. I also recommend fairly high-dose vitamin C along with that, usually about 2 grams a day. A buffered vitamin C is a great way to go because it doesn't irritate the stomach. So that's the nutshell version of it. Then the longer version of it is a lot of allergies are caused by hypersensitivity to the environment. So with most of my patients, I take an approach of healing the gut. And in the process of healing the gut, or what we call leaky gut, the body starts to become less sensitized to proteins and pollens in the environment, both through the digestive system and the respiratory system. So I take what's called a 4R approach, and I'll let you read about that on my blog if you want to go head over to my website, because I posted it just this morning, and it's a fun one. And that 4R approach is so applicable to many, many inflammatory conditions. Oh, another great boost for your allergies is to add some zinc as well. Zinc is a fantastic immune tonic for the respiratory passages, and for most adults, anywhere between 20 and 40 milligrams a day is a good dose.
I would love to make a plug right now for a particular nettles and quercetin combination product. I don't know how you feel, Aviva, about Eclectic Institute. Are you some
fantastic? I love their free
stuff. Oh my gosh!
Yeah,
I
really
have
good.
Suffered for a number of years from seasonal allergies, and I started taking the Eclectic Institute's combination nettles quercetin, and
yep.
I feel better within the hour. I mean,
it's amazing stuff.
It is amazing stuff.
Yeah.
So,
I'm there with you.
Do you mind if we take 2 more questions?
Mm-mm.
Do you have? Okay, great. This is from Jessie in Minneapolis. She says, I've worked with an herbalist here in Minneapolis who forages many of her own herbs and flower essences. If I can ask, where do the herbs that you prescribe come from? Would you be willing to share some of your favorite brands?
Absolutely. So there are many, many good brands. So my favorite brands do not necessarily mean they're the best. I think they're pretty darn good. And at this point, I don't have any financial ties to any company, so this is just what I use. One of my favorite companies is Herb Pharm. It's H-E-R-B-P-H-A-R-M. Another company that I absolutely love is called Gaia Herbs, G-A-I-A. Another company that I use quite a number of their products is Planetary Herbals. And those are they tend to have more capsules, and but they have some great formulas. Like they have a freeze-dried stinging nettles. They have a great formula for urinary tract infections. They also make an elderberry syrup that I love for kids. Those are probably my top three. Then I also really love Herbalist and Alchemist, which is David Winston's company, and MediHerb, which is Carrie Bone's company. And then Vitamica, I actually haven't used many of their products just because, you know, it's like when you shop, you tend to buy the same company over and over. It's just what I came up with using, so I do. But Vitamica is owned by Tori Hudson, or was owned by, she's the formulator for it. And that's also, they have some great formulations for women's health. And the reason I love those companies that I mentioned is not only are the products super high quality, but the companies are run by herbalists. They were started by herbalists. And herbalists tend to take pride in the quality of the starting product and know that the starting product is what's going to determine the quality of the end medicine. And they also tend to rely on a lot of traditional formulas from Western herbal medicine. And so often the combinations are very elegant and effective combinations. And I know the owners of every single one and the formulators of every one of those companies. I've been to their homes. You know, it's sort of like for me, I know what the quality of the product is because I know the quality of the person and the standards that they hold for themselves and for the industry. So that's what I tend to purchase. Yeah. In our clinic, we use Metagenics products. We use Pure Encapsulations. Oh, there's another company too, Natura, N-A-T-U-R-A, Natura Natural Products, which is Donnie Yance's company, and like those others, one of my favorites. In fact, the supplements that I get for myself are from Natura, and as I joke to my husband, when I say the supplements I take, and he's like, no, the ones that you buy and then don't take, because I'm the worst supplement taker. But, yeah, that's it. Those are great companies.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
This is from Clara in Miami. What would you recommend for endometrioma type cysts specifically?
So endometriomas are a little bit more complicated in that you are dealing with a local immune tissue reaction as well as a lot of inflammation. And so, frankly, with endometriomas, it's more a one-on-one individual consult that I would do with someone as opposed to sort of saying, oh, here's what I do for something like allergies, which is a pretty common pattern for most people. So for endometriomas, you want to look at what are the sources of inflammation in your diet, gut inflammation. Are there any environmental factors that you're being exposed to, like BPA, or other toxins that can be causing inflammation or can be causing your hormonal system to be dysregulated. So it's a little bit more complicated. I do have a section on endometriosis, which is a little different but similar, in my Botanical Medicine for Women's textbook, which might be helpful. But that's a little bit harder one to just sort of give an off-the-cuff pat answer for.
One more. This is from Regina in Portland, Oregon. I found out about you because of Jill, and I'm really intrigued by the new book that you advised on, the Herbal Handbook. I read your posts about it on Facebook. Can you tell us more about this book? Is it for practitioners or the public or both?
Well, it's really probably more oriented toward practitioners unless you're using a lot of herbs in your day-to-day life. I mean, it's certainly a great book to have on your shelf if you're just sort of an herbal geek and you want to add it to your library. But I'm just going to my shelf right now to pick it up, and it's 1,042 pages. It's pretty hefty, and it's got monographs on hundreds and hundreds of herbs. So it's not a juicy read. It's more of a reference book. But what happened was years and years ago, the American Herbal Products Association, which is sort of the botanical industry quality standard organization, created this book called The Botanical Safety Handbook. It was time for a revision, so Michael McGuffin, who is the executive director of APA, got a team together, and that team was me, Tirone Lowdog, who I mentioned earlier, a physician named Mary Hardy, a gentleman named Lyle Craker, who is a botanist out in the University of Massachusetts here in New England, Soaring Bear, who many people might know if they're old school hippies from his old dental self-help book, Roy Upton, who is the executive director of the American Herbal Pharmacopoeia, David Winston, who is an incredible herbalist, and he owns that company I mentioned, Herbalist and Alchemist, and Daniel Gagnon, who is also an amazing herbalist from the Southwest, and he owns a fantastic herb company called Herbs Etc. All of us contributed under the guidance of a woman named Zoe Gardner, who was doing her PhD in botany at University of Massachusetts at the time. And so Zoe gathered extensive research from the medical literature all over the world. We looked at pharmacopoeias from all over the world, and we got together on a regular basis on a phone conference, and we went through evidence after evidence after evidence, personal clinical experience. We weighed and discussed and finally came up with what we felt was the best represented safety evidence in the literature on each different botanical. It was a very exciting, kind of sometimes heated, sometimes passionate, but fun process to be part of. And my particular expertise was pediatric and obstetric botanical medicine, although we all contributed to all the different aspects of it. So if you're a geek, totally get it for your own library, but it's more for practitioners or formulators or product producers.
Thank you. Thank you so much for all of this. Thank you for taking the time to share your wisdom with us. This has been so enlightening and wonderful, and I'm so glad that I know about you, and so thankful for all the great information that you're putting out into the world.
Thank you, Jill. Such a thoughtful and fun interview. So thank you for inviting me to join you.
Oh, I'm glad you think so.
And to all the folks who are listening, thank you, too, and for your great questions.
We'll be back next Wednesday, the 17th, with fitness writer and editor and workout connoisseur Jen Sinkler. Jen is going to introduce us to intuitive training, finding the right exercises for you, and is going to show us how to take an experimental approach to exercise. Thank you again, Aviva, for taking the time to be with us. Thank you so much. So,
thank you, Jill.
Good night, everyone. Thanks for being with us. We'll meet here again next week at this time. Bye-bye.